Well, as you can hear, Shiva has ordained that the rainiest month retreat should commence. As every good weatherman follows how the wind blows and recognizes the time and the duties that are created by the conditions of the time. And so it feels appropriate to begin our Sangha retreat this evening rather than waiting until Tuesday, so that we can begin to build up momentum and make full use of this, what may be the final opportunity to have such an amount of time to focus upon the project of attaining liberation. And so I hope that every one of us takes very seriously the urgency of making use of every moment to shift the mode of operation of your consciousness from egocentricity to the absolute self. Because only that shift will bring freedom. And so the theme is freedom, freedom now. And the proof of freedom in a spiritual sense is contentment. Absence of conflict. Absence of duality and therefore of projection. Absence of contamination, of defilement, of loss of one's true nature, forgetfulness of the real. All of that needs to be let go of. Those are tendencies of the ego to fall into delusion. So let's see if we can use this next 2 weeks or so to be completely free of all delusions. The main delusion being that one is a conscious entity within a body, within a physical world. It's paradoxical that the state of being in the ego bubble is the state in which you don't think you are in a bubble. You believe you're in a real world, but in fact you are in a bubble of consciousness that is not a real world but is projected as one. This is the essence of the modern consciousness that came out of the Middle Ages with the beginnings of philosophy of a non-theological sort, as, for example, that of René Descartes, in which thinking became the proof of being. And there was a loss of connection with being itself, with the real. And what replaced it was the thought of the real. And once we lost touch with that fact of what is reality beyond thought, and we became immersed in the mental chatter of a being whose axioms included the belief that one is a consciousness that is sustained by the physical brain and the organism, and that has no existence beyond the organismic entity, then one lost the truth of being unborn, because the organism is born and it dies. And so if the consciousness is created by the brain, sustained by the brain, or even dependent in some way upon the brain, then it means that there is no hereafter. There is no life beyond the death of the body. And so modern consciousness became functionally atheistic, materialistic, and dualistic. And from there, devolved even further, because the sense of mortality creates fear, which creates attachments, security operations to compensate for the fear and for the lack of one's real consciousness, the lack of any true being, because now everyone in the modern consciousness is immediately indoctrinated into existentialism. Every ego is existentialist in its internal structure. What does that mean? The existentialist philosophy is based on the idea that your consciousness is without essence. You have existence but no essence. You come into the world shipwrecked, clueless, with amnesia, helpless, without any clear meaning to your life or to the world, without any clear purpose, without any clear order of what reality is about and what is the way to make best use of one's life. Without any internal order that it recognizes a verticality to consciousness any longer, but it has become a flatland consciousness focused upon the phenomenal plane, focused upon that which arises to the sensory modalities of the organism. And anything that is not part of that sensorium is by definition unreal. So the ego consciousness of the modern age, which becomes even more aggressively a tunnel vision in the postmodern period, because of even a loss of a monolithic sense of the ego, because of so much fragmentation and fracturing and dissociation that takes place. But the modern ego itself is a state of lostness and a state of disbelief that consciousness itself has any reality. And so it mistakes the unreal for the real and the real for the unreal. Everything is inverted. The classical understanding of reality is turned inside out and upside down. And that has been standardized. Everyone has been indoctrinated into this, even if you had a religious upbringing. And even if you have been taught to pray to a God, but that God can only be imaginarized. There is no actual contact. So if you were indoctrinated into a religious dogma, its only way of being acceptable was in a matter of belief that would go against the scientism of the underlying educational paradigm, and can only function then within the constraints of the demands of a family system seconded by a religious order into which one is inducted, but that one recognizes is a kind of subculture within a secular social order that does not recognize the validity of a power that is almighty and that transcends that of the figures and the institutions that have apparent power within the phenomenal plane. And so because the ego wants to be close to the centers of power, those centers are no longer the soul and almighty spirit, but they are now centers that are located within the phenomenal plane. And thus there is a dropping into a desublimation of consciousness, in which the intensity of experience wipes out the subtlety of imperience, or the total absolute subtlety of sumerience. Those no longer even are part of our accessible range of consciousness. And therefore, meditation per se has become impossible to the modern, and even more so to the postmodern consciousness. At the very moment when meditation is more essential, more urgent than it ever has been, because of the need to be able to respond to the chaotic situation of the world with peace, with intelligence, with coherence, the fragmentation of the ego makes it impossible to meditate. And it's only if we recognize that impossibility that we can overcome it. And this is why in this retreat we must study what is the nature of meditation, really? Because it cannot even be understood coherently by the ego mind. Its purposes to the ego could only be to have less stress, to manage the difficulties of life with more distance, etc. But meditation to the ego is the support of the ego, not the transcendence of the ego. And so real meditation of the authentic kind, if we want to be in authentic authenticity, is a state of consciousness unavailable to the ego that requires an entire inconceivable shift in the type of consciousness that we have, from egoic and egocentric to archetypal and to transcendental, and to the ultimate non-duality of the transcendental and the phenomenal. And that non-duality cannot be understood by the ego mind, for the very reason that its thinking apparatus is based upon the belief that A equals A, and A cannot equal non-A. It is this binary belief that paradox is incoherent, that there cannot be a union of the opposites. There cannot be a conjunctio, to use the alchemical term that Carl Jung borrowed and misused for his psychological approach. Because the conjunctio is not a conjunction of your conscious with your subconscious, which is all that psychoanalysis can imagine. And even the Jungians think of it as coming from an unconscious that is indigenous to the individual, as images that come from a different dimension of the individual self. But it doesn't come from the individual. It comes from the absolute self, in which there are no separate individuals. But this cannot be understood by the postmodern ego, because every thought is based on the I thought. And a thought in which there is no I and no other, and no subject and no object, cannot be retained, cannot even be imagined or conceived, cannot be metabolized, actualized. But that's what meditation is. So our process of understanding meditation has to be based on the taking in of the supreme knowledge at such a level that it creates a new center of consciousness within the ego itself. At the very heart of the ego, a presence that is empty of egoity has to emerge. An emptiness in which consciousness recognizes the relativity of the ego's thoughts. It recognizes that those thoughts do not have an absolute validity. Every ego in the postmodern period that we are in is skeptical and cynical. It cannot believe in the transcendent. It cannot even believe in the possibility of such teachings having validity. It cannot trust because of its basic paranoia. But what it cannot even do, which is the real key, is it cannot distrust its distrust. And so it is that development of an emptiness that perceives the subjective thoughts of the ego as mental objects that finally create a state of super subjectivity that overcomes duality. So meditation is the shifting of your focus of consciousness to make your subjectivity the object of your attention. And it's at that point that you realize that your subjectivity is welded to a projection of objectivity upon its own contents, so that its contents are disowned and projected out as if they belong to others, as if those contents of consciousness have a reality outside of consciousness. Is everyone following me so far? And so, when one has created this place of emptiness, we could call it the Holy of Holies within the secular, unholy consciousness that is wholly committed to belief that it's an organismic being in a world, and it was born, and it has parents, and it has a cultural attachment, and it has all kinds of connections to a real world, quote unquote. In that emptiness that recognizes that as the classical and medieval forms of consciousness recognize effortlessly, the world is in fact a dream or a field of dreams, an intersubjective whole in which what seem to be separate individuals are all really parts of a single whole unified field of consciousness. And the field becomes more important than the objects that appear in the field, or the subjective object that is the I thought that appears in the field. And once the field of consciousness itself becomes subjectified, then everything that had previously been considered to be external substances are now recognized as part of one's subjective creative intelligence that can no longer be validly conceptualized. Because in that emptiness, that space of egoless presence, every concept is recognized as a construct, a fabrication, a work of one's own mind to interpret one's own mind, but the interpretation is based on the belief that you are interpreting that which is not your own mind. And therefore, the interpretations must be false. And so with the withdrawal of one's automatic interpretations of the world and of one's own essence that had been precluded and occluded, but now is recognized as this emptiness, now there is an order that emerges from the realization of presence as completely indefinable. And it is the ultimate concept that reality is inconceivable that is realized, not thought, that shifts one from the symbolic to the real. And this is the state of samadhi. This is the goal of meditation. One has to have reached the ultimate concept of the fact that all concepts are false and that the real is inconceivable, and then realize that that itself is a concept, and to go through that concept into what is its referent. That's the state of nirvikalpa samadhi that will then be able to become sahaja samadhi. The word concept, you know, the sept, originally it was a hard K, not a soft C. It was concept. And the word kept is the same as the word kept, keeping, right? It grasping. The word concept meant originally to retain what is grasped. And the way you retain what is grasped in the real is to create a signifier so that you can remember what you once knew without going through language. And so the real purpose of the concept was to keep you in a state of transcendental realization without that falling into mental chatter. Because the chatter only takes place when you're in the imaginary register of believing that you are thinking about something that is beyond your consciousness. and trying to master it and control it. But once you recognize that you're dealing with your own consciousness, that there is nothing beyond it, then that is when you go beyond it, because you have transcended language. You have transcended the barrier that had created the illusion of duality. And this is what enables you to return to the original nature of consciousness prior to its bivalence into subject and objective realms. And so this is what we are reorganizing our consciousness to be able to sustain, which is a capacity that had atrophied in the modern age when we were forced to believe that we were bodily egos living a mortal life, which justified the development of a narcissistic ego structure and a rebellion against the other, against the Dharma, against all that was classically pertinent to the real, the supreme reality of our infinite, timeless, divine nature. And to return to that nature, we have to go against the current of the river, the stream of consciousness, back to its original point of descent, and find ourselves at the point at which the ego was first created, out of the soul consciousness that was originally recognized as a tentacle of the self, not a separate being from the self, but a mode in which the self would function in a field of infinite creative potentiality. And so it is this return to the original state of our purity of awareness that is the imperative at this moment as we approach the end of Kali Yuga and the total degradation of consciousness into its most demonic disfigurement. Until we have made that shift as a real mode of conscious perception, not belief, not faith, not a theory, but an actual immediate perception, we will not be able to overcome the mind's impossibility to grasp the non-duality of duality and non-duality. We cannot grasp what the Buddhists teach, that samsara is really nirvana. The ego thinks, no, nirvana must be elsewhere, there must be a difference. But it's the state of non-difference, and therefore it cannot be different from samsara. And samsara, indeed, must be nirvana, and nirvana must include samsara. It is this that is so difficult. And part of the reason it became difficult is that all of the religions of the, let's say, the final period of Kali Yuga sabotaged themselves, sabotaged their own founding teachings, and lost touch with them. And for the Buddhists, as the wheels of Dharma began to spin, became very difficult to hold on to a truth that for some was now provisional and for others was final, but now within a frame of reference that was no longer monolithic, no longer clear, no longer transmissible in its purity. And in an even worse case scenario in Christianity, for example, the original teachings of Rav Yeshua, who was a Jewish rabbi, a teacher of the Judaic or Israelite understanding of reality, those original teachings were burned and banned by Christian leaders themselves. The teachings of Rav Yeshua, who became known as Jesus Christ, were forbidden to be read by those who followed the religion of Christianity. The church itself became the Antichrist. And it was only in the 1940s when the Nag Hammadi scriptures or the scriptures that were buried in Nag Hammadi in Egypt were uncovered, that those that are now called the Gnostic Gospels, but are really the original Gospels, the ones that were written while the founder was alive and that transmitted much more accurately his teachings, were able to be known by Christians at large. But for 2,000 years, they had become an inconvenient truth to Christianity that followed false gospels that were written 75 to 100 or more years after the death of the founder and that had no relationship any longer to those original teachings. And so we have a situation in which the religions themselves have failed to conform to the knowledge that those branches of spiritual development were intended to enable to survive into the end of Kali Yuga. However, because God cannot be overcome, even through human attempts to egoically manipulate a religious establishment, we still have the ultimate paradox of Christ on the cross. And if we understand this from the modern perspective, it is the proof that Jesus failed, right? Why does he say at the end when he's on the cross, "Why have you forsaken me, Father," right? So according to the Gospels that were taught, Christ came to bring the kingdom of heaven right then. He didn't. He failed. He was executed as a criminal. And yet, his failure was understood by Christianity as success. So it is this paradox that failure equals success is the, let's say, the tip of the iceberg of that paradoxical reality that still survives, that became the Zen koan of Christianity. because to be a Christian, you had to believe that Christ was resurrected after his death. And that resurrection goes against all of the beliefs of modernity, which is why Christianity can no longer in general be believed in. And yet, because these teachings have survived so long, even in hereticalized forms, there is a power that still remains to those who are able to not have simple belief or even just faith, but a sense of the truth of the potentiality of resurrection for themselves. Not simply a belief in what happened to someone in Palestine 2,000 and some years ago, but a reality. And this is why I think it is so important that the near-death experiences have become so popular and so well-known and globally recognized as factual, that those who are clinically dead come back with stories of the afterlife and who also are able to know things that their body could not know while it was completely passed out and unconscious and clinically dead in the operating room or wherever it was, to the consciousness that would return hours or days later, that overheard accurately conversations that were had in different places and phenomena that occurred during that period, as well as information gleaned from the higher dimension that may have been visited by that consciousness. So there is a testament that is created through these scientific observations that cannot be denied because of the situation of a scientifically validated condition, because we now have machinery that that can prove and demonstrate that a flatlined consciousness without any brain activity is still able to experience, to learn, to know, and to locate itself non-locally and extra-dimensionally and become aware of non-corporeal beings who populate not only the phenomenal, but also those interim and intermediate realms of the angels and those who are on the other side, to use a favorite phrase of psychics. But it is this appearance within the modality of science itself that undoes the materialistic belief system. So there is enough evidentiary basis for a prima facie case for the reality of pure spirit, that if one has an open mind and trusts the science, will enable one to transcend the egocentric consciousness and recognize it for the delusion that it is. But this has to be realized in consciousness, not simply taken as a belief or a theory that is justifiably explorable by an open-minded being, but an actual realization that is attained through a breakthrough while in sober living consciousness, to realize that state of the infinite nature of our being here and now. And thereby to activate the powers of transformation that have atrophied within the ego, that can redream the world from that place of absolute spirit. And so this is the movement of the final phase of Kali Yuga, the return to non-duality, and a return in power, a return of God consciousness to the world that transforms the world into its true nature as singularity. And thence to a dream field that becomes redreamed. So meditation is now the ultimately important act that we can accomplish, but we can only accomplish it through our foregoing the implicit belief that what the ego perceives is reality. And it's only through our willing to overcome that delusion, seeing through it palpably, that we gain power to overcome the condition that consciousness is now in which it is helpless in the face of its inability to change a world that, if it were consciousness and just a dream and one were lucid in it, you would think one could change. But why is it then that a liberated being cannot eliminate symptoms of sickness in the body, or at least generally will not, and cannot change the world now into a place of peace instead of war? And why is it that the world dream now does not shift if there are liberated beings emerging within it? And that can only be understood from that place of the perfection of infinite intelligence, not from the limited intelligence of the ego that wants things to be better as a self-service to its own comfort zone within the organism. And so it is only through a sacrifice of the egoic frustration and suffering that is inherent to having a body that at the end of Kali Yuga is almost universally subject to pain, to conditions of chronic illness, to conditions like tinnitus, in which the ears make noise that the consciousness can't stop, but can tune out, can overcome in other ways, in the same way that one can overcome suffering of every kind that appears as a bodily condition or a mental condition or a karmic condition, if one has let go of that illusion of a dualistic paradigm of reality. But only if it has really been let go is one able to be without conflict, without fear, without desperate desire to feel lack, and to overcome those petty attachments that keep the ego in a sense of pseudo-certainty. So this is the work of a sat yogi, to overcome this mental block created by the egoic, delusional belief system. And it's only through the silencing of the mind in meditation, the reaching of that emptiness that connects as a portal to the fullness of the Absolute Self, that the true nature of our being can be downloaded and expressed fully while the body is alive in the phenomenal plane. And it is this attainment of Jivan Mukti that is the seal of graduation from this wheel of birth and death that is the wisdom school of the soul that enables one to earn the right to return to the throne of God. So I hope that everyone will use this opportunity that we have the luxury of enjoying to shift, to transform one's way of processing data of experience and of imperience to bring one into that non-duality of Samirience in which there was never any birth, never any world, never a creation, never anything other than the Absolute Self in the glory of its infinite creativity. I think that's all I have to say. So open the retreat. Namaste. Floor is open if there are any questions or comments that anyone would like to make. Basra? Talk loud, please.
I wanted to ask, because right at the point where you said, is everybody following me, I was totally lost in this idea of subjectivity and objectivity. It's always kind of confounded the mind. I think that's the point, and not supposed to understand it in an ego mind. But when you said shifting the focus of consciousness to make subjectivity the object of attention, like that whole sentence, I just have so many questions. Can you explain it?
Okay, sure. Usually you take your thoughts as the insignia of subjectivity. Right? That's the Cartesian thing. I think, therefore I am. So I is a thought. Right? It is a thinking process. The I that is the awareness of the thought is lost. So only when you have divorced your identification from the thinking apparatus and process and stream of thought production to the unchanging awareness in which those thoughts now are not your subjectivity anymore, but are objects that appear to your subjectivity, which is now at a deeper level of awareness that is no longer identified with language and therefore no longer identified with the constructs that appear in language, but is now itself the inconceivable real. Only when that shift has happened can you deconstruct the whole world that your ego mind has created as an external reality and return to a non-dual recognition of what is as the pure immediacy of that awareness itself. Does that make it clearer? How many people thought that was clear? Okay, there's a few.
Shifting the focus of consciousness, right? How is it consciousness or attention that is shifting?
Well, that the attention is shifting to the awareness from the thinking.
And the awareness, okay, you're saying is the I am before.
Awareness never changes. It's presence, for which there is no past, no future, and no other, no difference.
And that's the subjectivity.
That's the real subjectivity that is no longer within the frame of reference of a duality of subject and object.
Because when I say I, Vajra says I, what comes after is all objective.
It is a false a subjectivity that is mm-hmm. actually identified with an object. Okay?
That's clear. Thank you.
Because language is an object. You acquire it. You take it in. But you didn't create it. It didn't emerge from within. You learned it. And you had to learn by some very vague attempt to understand what the signifiers that your parents were telling you and eventually school teachers and others were telling you, what they really meant by what they said. But you were never actually sure. So everyone has both a private language and a public illusion of language in which I think we understand each other, but here it's clear we don't, which means we actually do. You see, because you cannot actually use signifiers to create rapport. Rapport is an energetic and vibrational frequency resonance. It is not a ping-ponging of shared concepts.
So in the realm where there is no language, there's also not a judgment. It's just an observation.
It's a realization, because it's not even an observation, because to observe means to be a subject observing an object, right? So it's not even observation. It's serving, but it is serving consciousness. It is the recognition that everything is given by the infinite presence of the real itself, and that what one is simply a manifestation of awareness of that infinite gift of infinite creativity, and that is that's what creates real devotion, the real Mahabhava, right? The realization that I am in the mind of God at this very moment, and all I really am is a manifestation of God's creative intelligence. As long as I let go of the ego belief system, because that secularizes and degrades my understanding of who I am.
And the I that realizes that is the...
It has to be the self. Can't be realized. Only the self can realize the self. That's why the ego can't do it. That's why the ego can't meditate. The soul is that first recognition of the emptiness that's beyond the ego. It's the negation of the ego. And then there's the negation of the negation, because that emptiness is not personal. It's not my awareness. The my drops out, and then there is the real. Okay.
Thank you.
Bruce.
Thank you, Shunya. I just wanted to ask you to clarify. I didn't follow when you were talking about the Christ crucified as failure taken as success. I wasn't sure of what you were trying to...
Jesus failed, right? He didn't bring the kingdom of heaven. He didn't rid the Israelites of the Roman occupiers, right? He was executed as the worst kind of criminal and traitor and right all of that. So his mission failed from a phenomenal perspective. And from a Jewish point of view, he can't be the Messiah because he failed, right? So QED, quod erat demonstrandum, he's not the one. But the Christian says no, his failure is the proof of his success. He is the one. And the Gnostic Gospels actually prove that that's true, even though it can't be proven from the Synoptic Gospels, because they simply record the failure, right? But if you read the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Mary Magdalene or any of those early Gospels, Yeshua is not saying the kingdom of heaven will come in the future. He's saying it's here now, but you don't see it. You don't perceive it because you're in ego consciousness. And he taught them how to perceive through the third eye. Remember, let thine eye be single and you'll be filled with light. I think that one, that's actually escaped into the other Gospels, but the real meaning of that didn't. but it's in the others. And so he succeeded. He actually did transmit the truth to at least a few of his disciples, and even a few of the apostles later on who didn't know him but got it, like Paul, I think, got it. But then it was diluted by other apostles who were involved in the politics of Rome versus Israel and had to make the Jews the bad guys, etc., and so had to turn him into a prophet of the future rather than a teacher of presence. So, but the paradox of failure equaling success, in a way, is a beautiful example of non-duality, right? And the union of the opposites. Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
Hanuman.
Thank you, Shunya. I really appreciate the framework that you've given tonight. It helps me to see, like, I mean, I've been really trying to observe where my ego came from and trying to understand how everything I see and everything that I believe, everything I think, is all based on this structure that was created by a child. And even though I can understand that as a concept, I can't really do anything about it. Like, I feel today I was taken up into this inability to break through, like, the sad, serious, frustrated feeling that is created by that structure. Mm-hmm. And even though everyone around me was in joy and laughing, I felt really sad and serious.
They were sad too behind the laughter, don't worry.
Well, it seems like that's part of what you're saying, is that it's universal. It's not like, my ego is so bad, you know, like I understand that it helps me to not believe in it,
right?
And not to take it as if it's some kind of, like I'm a victim of it. And I think that's been really helpful to try to take responsibility for creating the structure as some kind of a necessary defense at the time it was created. But then now taking that responsibility a step further and saying, okay, now I'm responsible for letting go of it.
Yeah.
And what feels like the next challenge is being able to be, let's say, swallowed up by the feelings, the affects or the emotions that come from that, and still not believing in it.
Yeah.
Like I saw myself like going into almost like a Tourette syndrome, cussing at myself for having gone into those feelings and like letting them ruin the moment, right? And yet then there was still like a feeling of separateness from that. Like I wasn't really believing that's real. And yet I still felt all the feelings, and yet I didn't like buy it really.
Great.
But I feel that there's still, I still believe that I'm this body and I have a history and it's a story that I tell myself and tell others and that I'm somehow now trying to like heal it or to end it or to go back to a more pure state or...
Right. Okay, so you've made excellent progress. But here's the real difficulty. You weren't born with an ego, or at least before you were born, you didn't have an ego. You may have had a proto-ego even in the womb because of your mother's ego that would have entered your consciousness, and you would have gained an ego early in life. But there is a sense that it's an acquired construct. It's not natural to you, right? So, but once it is acquired, every thought you have is the ego's thought. So the ego believes its narrative. And you cannot get out of it by creating a counter-narrative, because all narratives will lead you back into the ego. No counter-narrative will end up freeing you. It will just produce another, maybe a slightly improved form of suffering, right? So this is why Ramana says you have to answer the question, who am I, accurately. And there's no answer you can give in words. There's no narrative, because there is no individual I. What is actually taken as I is amness, if you will, but without the I. It's presence, it's awareness. But it's awareness without a core that has an intention and a desire and a need to break through, or any of those feelings that come from the ego itself. And so it's only by witnessing the narrative process without identifying with it or taking part in it, but staying in the silent emptiness that makes your ego an object to you, right? By totally not buying into it, and by realizing you can't create an alternative. An alter ego won't get you out of the ego. It's only the realization of the silent presence that will then bring in an entirely different type of consciousness that it never had anything to do with the ego, never was born, never was identified with a body, and never projected a world. It's only at that point that your true nature will be revealed by itself. Not that you will do something to reveal it, because that you is the false. So it happens by itself, because there is only the self. And it's that which is, from the ego's perspective, can only be understood as a surrender and a silencing and a giving of one's mind, one's life, one's being, everything to that source of one's real nature, and then that will be actuated as a wiping away of the egoic mind, not a replacement with another set of thoughts. Okay? All right. Thank you. Okay. Yogi Raj.
Thank you. It was interesting what you were saying about concept actually being con-kept. Made me think about concentration. Like in the past, you had described concentration as being at the center of like concentric circles. But is it possible to concentrate without it being something that's actually coming from the ego?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what's the difference between concentration at those two levels?
Because it is no longer I who am concentrating. It is an emptiness, a zero point, that is the real center of the concentric circles of awareness, right? Starting with, let's say, the mental, emotional, sensory, and whatever phenomenal levels you want to conceptualize. But at the very core of it, if you concentrate on who is concentrating, there's no one there. There's just an empty awareness, like a mirror, but a mirror without the images. So it's just that. It's the pure potentiality of perception of what will appear in the mirror as if it's out there, but is actually coming from the mirror itself. It is actually empty and full, paradoxically, at the same time.
So I think that I recognize that happening in my consciousness. It starts off as a mental act, and then it becomes far less specific to like a body. Like, can you describe what it would actually feel like? Because it seems like body identification drops away as concentration from that deeper level is actually happening.
Okay, if I understand your question, you're asking to describe what does it feel like to reach that level of formless consciousness?
Yeah, and how would it differ from concentrating as a mind?
As a mind?
Yeah, like to describe the process of concentrating as a psychological act versus concentration coming from the emptiness.
Well, if you're concentrating from the mind, you'll have thoughts. There'll be reflections. There'll be observations. They may be insights. But it'll be still in the mental plane. Whereas when there's pure awareness, all thoughts and constructs will disappear. And what you will become aware of, literally, is light. Light and intelligence. And the light itself is the intelligence that can then be seen via constructs as a world, but is in fact only light. And when one disidentifies from all intentions toward the light, from all desire to differentiate objects in the light, then it returns to that radiant sameness that Satpurusha talks about. And there is only the self that sees itself, but there is no other.
Okay, so to go back to that word concept, is the origins of concentrate the same? Is it with a K as well, or is it it's a different...
It's different, because it comes from the concentric. And the concept is a... it's a retention of the knowledge of the perceiver, but without going through all of the logical processes that it would take to get to the center, right? That's the neti-neti. Concentration is, okay, I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm not... There's a process of an I trying to get to its own center. Right, that is the concentration process, but if the ultimate concept of the inconceivable is grokked, one's automatically there. There's no process.
When you use the word referent,
what's that?
You use the word referent.
Refer. Yes.
How does that apply to what you just described? Because at first I thought, like referent and signified might be like used interchangeably, but referent is more what's being pointed to.
Yeah, it's not the signified, because the signified is still a concept.
Okay.
It is the real. Uh-huh. It is the inconceivable, not the thought or the idea of the inconceivable.
So could you say that the signified is how the ego concentrates and the referent is concentration more at that level of...
Yeah, it's the result of transcending the ego.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Nirgun.
Thank you, Shinya. In a way, you've already spoken to what I'm going to ask, especially at the beginning of the teaching.
I was hoping that would be enough.
I'm sure it is. It is enough. I just wanted to ask, just in case there was anything more that you wanted to say or anything that you wanted to state differently for a more general audience.
It's very important now to learn how to meditate, which will bring you into a state of peace and coherence and detachment from conditions, into an unconditional sense of your being that is fearless and without suffering, and to be able to sustain that state that is attained in deep meditation in order to cope with and face and go through the events that are imminent or already occurring in the phenomenal plane, and that are exponentially increasing in their extreme nature of destructiveness. And meditation is designed to bring you into the realization of your indestructible nature as immortal and eternal consciousness. And if you gain that, you will be able to deal with whatever arises in the phenomenal plane with great accuracy and in the service of the highest purposes of the source of our being to uplift everyone back into the consciousness of God, the Buddha nature, the ultimate reality that recognizes what is happening as a blessing and as part of the perfection of the Godhead in which we find ourselves, and not as some horror and some evil takeover of the world by demonic entities, even though that is how it will appear to the egoic mind. But that appearance is not its ultimate nature. And so it's only through attaining that deep meditative state of non-duality that we can see through the illusion into what is actually being given to us by that being of supreme goodness that is the ultimate self that is our true nature. So I hope everyone learns to master the art of meditation and to gain what is our eternal birthright, and be able to serve as beings who are angels and bodhisattvas and servers of the divine goodness in this time of apparent evil. Okay, I hope that helps.
Very much so. Thank you, Shinya.
Anyone else? No.
First of all, thank you very much for this fascinating teaching. I have a comment and then a question. So my first comment is that it seemed, as you were speaking, as many have shared, impossible to follow the intensity of what you're saying and the subtlety, if you wish. So that's my first comment. And however, I did see myself nodding as, oh, of course, yes, it makes... And there was a moment where I was observing the two, right? The one that was trying to pay attention and not miss one word, mm-hmm. with the one that was actually nodding and saying, yeah, mm-hmm. that makes total sense, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that there was a grokking that was happening as you were speaking that mm-hmm. the conscious mind was not aware of.
Right.
And I want to ask you about that because I'm very intrigued by that.
Yes. It's the difference between the soul that groks and the ego that tries to understand. Mm. And the soul gets it at a level of vibrational resonance, and it goes immediately into one's intuitive knowing, mm. but not necessarily into one's ability to think out what is being said in some linguistically mm-hmm. logical form. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's a leapfrogging of language and thought mm-hmm. into presence, but presence that contains the intelligence that already knows everything.
So what makes that happen? What allows what, let's say, what would be the word? Not activate, but what is it? What is in place that allows one? Or
the
what
soul's love of God. And the love creates a connection so that whatever is coming from higher consciousness will be understood by the heart, mm. the wisdom of the heart, not necessarily of the mind. Mm. And that's much more important than the mind, which we'll get it later mm-hmm. by studying it, mm-hmm. but doesn't need to have it at that level, because it's the opening into the emptiness that leads to the fullness that is what we are really aiming at, mm-hmm. not simply as some theoretical understanding.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Thank you. And so my question is, I want to validate this to see if I understood well, but when you are explaining about the subjectivity and the objectivity, right? And this, it seems to me that there are different levels of subjectivity as one is able to, let's say, refine one's ability to be in silence, maybe. I don't know if that would be the right explanation. But there's, you just explained to me the soul level, right? The first step to me seems the importance of meditation which allows one to be, to quiet the mind enough, so in a much more subtle, let's say, state, to observe the ego mind speaking and chattering and saying everything it's saying, yeah. Or even that's observing right. one's ego acting out when one is saying, well, why am I saying this? That's why right. did I get, you know, upset? Or why am I sad? But there's an observer there, which yeah. is the first step, right? Of many that's steps, right. Is that correct?
Several, but not that many. Because once you reach the silence of the ego mind, the soul is awakened. Mm-hmm. At least it's activated, mm. and eventually, or even quickly, the soul realizes its nature is completely separate from the ego, and it doesn't even need the ego. The ego is actually an obstruction, mm-hmm. and that's when then the soul will take the next step and dissolve itself into its own infinite source. In the Godhead or the Buddha nature or the infinite self, right? So it's really just those two shifts that are required. Observing the ego, realizing it's the soul, and then the soul, through love of God, becomes one. And that ultimate union, once it's consummated, even the soul disappears. And as does the world and all otherness, even though its traces as a phenomenal illusion remain, but the real is completely so overwhelming that nothing that happens matters, literally, because it's not material anymore. It's all pure consciousness.
That's beautiful. Okay. Thank you. So this explains to me the importance of meditation, because it yes. is when one is ever more distant from the objectivity and... Yeah. I'm sorry, from the objectivity and the subjectivity, one is able to reach that ultimate subjectivity, right?
Yes, but, and this is where I think the tantric Buddhists are very useful interlocutors of this process, because what they say is that you have to stop meditating and begin non-meditation, you see? Because there is no one meditating. And as long as you think, I am meditating, you're still in the ego. Yes. And your meditation will not reach the total silence. It's only when there is no one any longer to meditate, because you've let go of that delusion, that real meditation happens.
Yes. Makes sense. Okay? I can grok that, although I can't okay. repeat it. But thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Is there any last... comment, question? Ah, okay.
I also want to say thank you for this teaching. I'm happy that you spoke and that we're going more deeply into the topic of meditation and understanding it better, because I've been trying to understand it and trying to sort of learn and seeing all of the mistakes that I make and all of the actions inside that create tension in all of this. And so my question has to do kind of with what you just explained of I guess the soul recognizing that it doesn't need the ego, and so it lets it go. What I experience during meditation is, you spoke as well about the current, let's say, that one needs to swim up against, and so there's an experience of that current. And you've mentioned before as well the churning of the ocean inside. So perhaps it's all part of it, but trying to understand non-duality, which is in that sense impossible, I think, it feels like I'm making a mistake of seeing the inner conflict of those two streams, let's say an upward stream and a downward stream. I see that as an object in consciousness, which makes it... feel like there's a subject that's battling with an object, which mm-hmm. creates a tension and a sense of effort, which only seems to hinder the meditation. Mm-hmm. And so I've been trying to grok that point as well, of there being no meditator, because it almost seems like that would be the answer. Mm-hmm. But how does that go?
Well, that's why Sri Ramana says, instead of trying to meditate by, in the sense of doing something or fighting against the mind or all of that, is simply ask, who am I? The I being the awareness of the mind and of this conflict and the different streams. And when one recognizes that one is pure awareness, not a thinking being, and not a speaking being, not a language user or an artifact of language or constructs, but that which is inconceivable, then the letting go of all of those thought streams will be effortless. And that's when the current of Shakti that connects the soul to the self will be felt. And the augmentation of the energy field of consciousness will become so strong that it can sustain the silence. It is no longer battered by an intention to divert your attention from presence into thought. And it's then that energy, as you focus on it, brings you to ever higher states of joy and then bliss and then just infinite light and freedom and love of God that creates that union from which you would never want to return any longer. And so all of the desires of the ego become obsolete and wither away as you enter into total fulfillment that brings a kind of contentment that has no interest in going back into the ego mind. And that's when liberation is achieved. It's effortless and it's automatic.
That's beautiful. So one last question is then just to ask, if there would be any process, this would be the process, that focusing on the power, letting it expand and grow, letting it be strong enough to overcome the ego.
Yeah. But it's not a process you do. It is what happens by itself. That's why it's... Even to think of it as a process is not entirely accurate. It's an unfoldment, a revelation that becomes redemption.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Okay, well, I hope that this was useful. And if mind-boggling, at least that it gives you something to churn about and to focus on that will enable you to use your thinking apparatus to recognize its own point of failure so that you can break through and transcend a dependence on conceptualization, right? Because that's what we have to overcome, is an addiction to words, so that we grok instantaneously and in immediacy the real that cannot be objectified or conceptualized, because it is infinite and eternal and beyond the illusion of being laid out in space and time and multiplicity, but is an actual unitive whole. But that cannot be fully languaged. You can hint at it, which I try to do with these words, but only to point to that which can only be known in stillness and silence by flatlining the mind, as if your body was clinically dead, but in fact only the ego is dead. But that produces the same result of liberation into the supernal light. And so I hope everyone will have a self-created near-death experience, which is the death of the ego and the realization of the presence of God, not somewhere else, but in a higher vibrational frequency that is here and now, and that is realized as the truth of all of reality, not just some transcendent dimension for a few, but is the reality of everyone, because there is only one, and that one is the zero point of infinite beauty of pure presence. That is who we are. May we know that and be that and transmit that vibrational frequency to every node of consciousness until the world or the energy field that this is lights up like a Christmas tree with eternal lights of divine beauty. Namaste.